Hey everybody, this is Jeff Horwich, and I'm going to be right up front. I'm a little bit sick today, maybe more than a little bit sick, and so don't get too close to me, and I'm going to keep this introduction good and short. Today's In the Loop podcast is definitely kind of a departure for us, and it might not be for everybody, but that's kind of the nice thing about a podcast. If it's not working for you, why don't you just duck out, and we'll see you next time. But I hope you'll stick with it for a while, at least, because I think it might pull you into some issues that you probably haven't thought about very much. What we have here is a roundtable discussion I hosted a couple of weeks ago, and here's the premise. It's an election year, of course, and we're going to hear lots more about how various groups of voters are leaning, right? Black voters, Hispanic voters, young voters, old voters, boomer voters. So for our part, we were thinking about other groups of voters who might have an interesting perspective on the election. And so we decided to convene a small group of folks who have a truly unique view of the American political process, American Indians. Seemed like we hadn't heard very much about them so far. So that's it. Seven folks with various tribal affiliations and political views came into the studio, and we talked politics for about an hour. I thought the conversation was terrific, and it opened my mind to a whole political perspective that really should matter to all of us, whether we're Indian or not. You can judge for yourself, of course. So thanks again to all of our panel members who came in and made this happen. And podcast listeners, here you go. So it's difficult to put together a small group that, in some sense, is completely representative of a very large and diverse population. But what we've done today is tried to pull together a number of folks from various American Indian communities who are politically engaged and willing to sit down, talk with me, talk with each other about what matters in the election that's going on right now, what kind of candidates are resonating with the people in their communities, and what issues are going to be important going forward. So why don't we just start going quickly around the table here, and we'll start with you, Al, if you want to just give us your name and maybe the one-sentence summary of what you're all about.
My name is Al Paulson, and I'm former chairman of the Minnesota American Indian Chamber of Commerce and co-founder of the National Indian Business Association with offices in Washington, D.C. I have a business called Marketplace Productions and enrolled member of the White Earth Band of Minnesota Chippewa. Born up in northern Minnesota, now my offices are here in St. Paul.
Great. Thanks for being here. Let's keep going. Carrie?
My name is Carrie Plowman. I'm a Kotsape Dika Paiute from California. And a board member of the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits and used to be a part of the Indian Chamber of Commerce, and I still work in the chamber industry.
My name is Anna Marie Hill, and I'm an enrolled member of the Red Lake Nation, and I'm currently the executive director of the Indian Affairs Council, State of Minnesota.
My name is Reed LeBeau. I'm an enrolled member of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe from South Dakota. I'm an attorney with Lockridge Grindle Nowen in Minneapolis, and I practice among other things, Indian law and campaign finance and election law.
Great.
My name is Arlana Omaha. I work at Migazi Communications. I'm part Lakota, part Ojibwe from Rosebud, South Dakota, and my mom's from Leech Lake, Ojibwe. And I currently work with youth at Migazi Communications.
Hi, I'm Alex Bufflehead. I am a student at BRAC, and I'm enrolled at Sisseton and live here in the Twin Cities.
And you'll be voting for the first time this fall, right?
Yeah.
I'm glad you're here. Okay, and Jamie.
Well, yes, I'm Jamie Edwards, enrolled with the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe, and I'm also the Government Affairs Coordinator for the Mille Lacs Band.
Well, let's start with the presidential candidates, and we'll move on later to some of the issues in the campaign and some of the issues here at the state level. I'm going to throw a statement out for you guys to consider, and this came from a member of this group, as a matter of fact. Of the three people running, if any of them has the best understanding of Indian issues, it's John McCain. Who wants to take that on, pro or con?
I'll start. Yeah, I think that,
This is Al Paulson.
Al Paulson. Overall, I think he has probably the best handle on Indian issues of any of the candidates running in the presidential election because of where he's from, Arizona, and the issues he's been involved in. He's been on the Senate Selection Committee for years.
The Indian Affairs Committee.
Indian Affairs Committee,
right.
This is Jamie Edwards. Not that I disagree with Al, but I think Senator McCain has proven over the years to have a grasp and a clear understanding of tribal sovereignty. But over the last few years, that respect for that understanding that he clearly seemed to have for many years has come under question based on some proposed legislation that was really paternalistic, which kind of goes counter to...
What specifically are we talking about here? Is this the Indian gaming
legislation? This is Indian gaming legislation that several of the provisions were paternalistic. At least that's how they were viewed by a majority of the tribes across the U.S.
And tell me about why that's such a pejorative term to say paternalistic. And Jamie, you can take that or anybody else at the table here.
This is Reed. I definitely, I'm in Al's camp. And
there in terms of being a McCain supporter, you're in Al's camp, right?
Right. There was some proposed legislation a few years ago dealing with changes to the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act that would have had more federal government involvement in certain aspects of Indian gaming that right now don't have that amount of oversight. The federal government has a very bad history of sort of being extremely involved, being not very involved, wanting to run everything, wanting to run nothing. I think that there was definite concern in Indian country and among tribal governments that if that proposed legislation was to go through, it would have changed that relationship quite a bit. My view of it was I didn't agree with it, but Senator McCain seemed to be coming from a place of at least understanding and wanting to make the Indian gaming industry better, although I think that his means of going about it were wrong-headed.
You know, this is Kerry, and I think the one thing with McCain, and I'm not necessarily a McCain supporter, but I recognize that at least when it comes to Indian business, he's had a long time in there in terms of serving people from his state, understanding some of the issues, and hoping and trying to work on some of the empowerment things to let the individual rise to the top. And that's oftentimes an important issue with business.
Is this somebody who can maybe crack the trend of Indians as a whole tending to vote Democratic?
This is Al. To clarify that, the Indians in the lower 48 tend to vote Democratic. Up in Alaska, it's the other way around. The Indian folks up there have kind of gotten a little more independent. They've really thrown out BIA. They don't work with them very well compared to down here. There's a whole different mentality and a whole different mindset.
Can McCain have any impact on those voters not in Alaska?
Oh, here?
Be more inclined to go with one of the Democrats?
Sure. I think there are quite a few Indian voters that are going to be voting for him. Most of them are still in the closet because it's tough to come out of the closet with that. I think there's one tribal leader in the state of Minnesota that tried it, and Audrey Bennett, she was a tribal leader from the Prairie Island community that was recognized as being a big supporter of Bush, and she wanted to have that out there.
This is Kerry. Al, do you think it trends based on age, that some of our older Indian voters would be more inclined to McCain because of their experience versus some of the younger voters who are caught up in the hoopla of some of the other, the Democratic?
That could be part of it. I think what's part of it is that I think some of the tribal leaders around the country are seeing that they would rather have the solutions for their tribes back at their tribe. And they would also rather have their solutions be more economic development solutions rather than the government handouts. Generally, that's the Republican philosophy.
So there's some philosophical pickup here, potentially, think, for Republicans that maybe they haven't really tapped into?
I think philosophically, the tribal leaders would rather have the decisions made at their own tribal level as opposed to Washington, which is generally a Republican philosophy. I mean, Republicans generally don't see big government as solving their problems for them.
Well, let's talk about the Democrats and what they have to offer. We'll start with Hillary Clinton.
This is Jamie.
Sure, Jamie, what's the
appeal? I'm a Hillary supporter, but I do want to just take a step back in regards to Senator McCain. I think Senator McCain has proven to be respectful of Indian country, but of recent history, it's hard to point to something specifically that's really important that he's championed on behalf of Indian country. So I think right now we're in an environment with Indian people and tribal governments becoming much more politically savvy. The litmus test is no longer just an understanding of and a respect for tribal sovereignty. It is what will you do? What kind of initiatives are you going to put forward? What kind of relationship are you going to present? And unfortunately, recently, the Republican administration, the current administration, the Bush administration, has not done well in that area. There has not been the kind of communication and solid relationship that existed under the Clinton administration. They kind of established the bar. So that's part of the reason why I'm supporting Hillary Clinton.
Sure, and Hillary and Obama both have policy statements out there, yes, trying to sort of express how they would relate to Indian country. And JB, why don't we keep going with you and then we can pass it around. But what is it that they are that they're saying?
Well, in the case with Hillary and under Bill Clinton, I've been around just long enough to have been doing some work when Bill Clinton was in office, and there was constant communication from the White House into Indian country, and you know, with Mille Lacs specifically, there were communication coming via fax and other methods of communicating and extending a hand, which is really about partnership, and it's about respecting the government-to-government relationship that exists. And very early on, you know, Hillary recognized that and came out with a policy statement that addressed that, addressed how her plan, if elected, was to increase the number of positions within her administration, where young Indian folks like ourselves, if we just happened to be in D.C., there would be opportunities there. And that was something that existed, again, under her husband's administration. And I think that's she's identified that very early on, and that's a good position to have moving forward.
One of you, it might have been you, Jamie, said on the phone to me, there seems to be a lot of buzz about Hillary in Indian country. I don't recall who said that, but would you guys agree with that? Is there traction there?
This is Reed. I think she came out very early and tried to make it clear that she was on the side of Indian country and that she had particular policies geared toward them. I think she was probably the first one out of the gate after announcing her intention to run that, you know, there was specific Indian directive sort of going to be driving her campaign. So,
I just want to back up just a little bit. Jamie had made a comment that Senator McKay has proven clear that he has an understanding of tribal sovereignty. And I do want to state from a Indian Affairs perspective, or what we've been working hard to do is educate legislators and people of the public on that tribal sovereignty. And I do think that, you know, saying McCain perhaps has, you know, it wasn't stated that he has the most clear understanding, because that may not be the case intellectually or by any means, but he has proven he has the most experience, and he does, out of the three candidates. But that understanding of tribal sovereignty is so key and critical to understanding us as a people and how we govern.
For lawmakers, right, up and down, absolutely, the chain, how deep is that level of understanding of
how
what
deep is that
means?
Level? That, yeah, level of understanding is very shallow. It's in a lot of cases, it's next to none. It is a question that is oftentimes stated either, well, why is this, or this offends me. It's been actually told that this offends me from very close colleagues. And that covers all political parties. That's not something that,
and you encounter this at the state level
all
where
the
you
time.
Work.
We encounter it all the time. But I do want to say also that when I was working as the lobbyist or government relations person for the Red Lake Reservation, we did go to meet. This was under Clinton administration, and we did go to the Capitol. And one of the things, with the exception of Senator Wellstone, and who was just treated us marvelously. He treated us wonderfully whenever we met with him. In most of the cases, Chairman Whitefeather, who I accompanied, is the leader of our nation. And we were not allowed to meet with people but staff. And at that time, for the 3 days that we were there or so, 2 or 3 days, I didn't understand why my leader of the nation was ushered to staff. Not in all cases, but it was there. What I want is that clear understanding that he does not meet with staff, he meets with the head of the nation. Mm-hmm. So that's where the sovereignty lies.
Are you seeing any of the candidates really reach out and try to convey that they have a grasp of that, a true, deep grasp of it? Obama, Hillary?
Bill Richardson. He's no longer in the race.
Well, I was going to ask whether there were other candidates who've fallen by the wayside in the course of the primaries who might have been the most appealing of all.
My joke has been, you know, whichever of the Democratic candidates picks Bill Richardson, that settles it for me.
Really?
I mean, in some ways. I mean,
so that endorsement the other day was hugely important.
He was a great, you know, potentially for Indian country, and some of the things in his background, his resume, you know, I really liked him.
Did Obama need that sort of credibility? What else has he got maybe going for him that would make him resonate in Indian country?
This is Reed. I mean, I think the Obama factor, whatever they call it now, is just so, it's sort of taken on a life of its own at this point. I think regardless, that cuts across ethnic lines. He's achieved rock star status in a way that, you know, I don't think the American electorate seen for quite some time.
Sure. Alex Buffalohead, you're our younger voter here. Are you thinking about Obama?
Kind of. Through this conversation, I'm kind of leaning back and forth between Hillary and Obama.
So what's giving you pause? What have you heard in the last few minutes that makes you think about things a little differently? Because you came into this as an Obama supporter.
Right. What Reed was saying about McCain's involvement and, like, throughout time he's been involved, like, he's more experienced, and I haven't really heard of that.
Well, that's the sort of thing you hear about Obama. People go at him on all kinds of different issues, I guess. You know, where's your record, your background? You have some great things to say about it. But, you know, in Indian issues, maybe that applies as well.
I think Hillary's probably she's clarified it pretty well, his experience.
Yeah, I'll this is Arlena. I want to say something.
Yep, Arlena, you've been I want my chomping at the bit over there to jump in. Go ahead.
First of all, I'm going to go ahead and say that when I was reading up on this stuff from Obama, I mean, when I seen his speeches, he just talks about, the Native Americans are the poorest, and they're at the bottom of this, and they're at the bottom of that. And I'm like, wait a minute, this is common sense. We already know. You know, we already know that we have it bad. Okay, we need to get past that. And then that's why I really liked Hillary's statement when she talked about, this is what I plan to do. I plan to appoint people to office. I plan to help with higher education. I plan to help with law enforcement. I mean, Native American tribes really need to have their own sovereignty rights and have more policies where they can actually have more power within reservations, because a lot of the power, because of federal Indian law, is taken away. We need somebody in there who knows, you know, about Indian country and who knows what they're talking about.
So. And when you look at the facts on the ground, even say Bill Richardson's endorsement of Obama doesn't
honestly do I don't know. So I don't know anything about Bill Richardson, so I don't have anything to say about
this
that.
Is Reed. You make some very good points about the complexity of Indian law, and one thing that I never hear brought up is that the branch of government that has most affected Indian law has not been Congress or the presidency, it's been the court. And the thing we hear the most when presidential candidates get asked about Supreme Court appointments is typically abortion or, well, I guess that's probably the main one. But I don't hear, what is your position on Indian law and tribal sovereignty?
If it's possible to do it in a nutshell, I guess, what are some of those fundamental issues that may come before the Supreme Court or the other federal courts where you'd really want to hear from a presidential candidate where they stand?
Well, right now, there are significant issues between unions and tribes and unionization of casino employees or even government employees. And knowing how one of these three presidential candidates, what the judicial philosophy of their nominees would be, I think would be really crucial.
I think one of the major accomplishments would be the Major Crimes Act. Because the Major Crimes Act is something, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that goes on within Indian country that gets overlooked, or there's a lot of cases because at the federal level, I mean, if something happens, if somebody is murdered or if somebody is raped, it goes to federal. And some of the times those cases, people automatically go to jail. So, I mean, there's tons of different issues within Indian country that need to be addressed. For me, it's just as long as who's ever in there is educated and takes the time to obtain that education on federal rights and, you know, the sovereignty rights of Native Americans. And like I said, I was really impressed when I seen Hillary's statement on Native Americans, so I'm just going
to
say that.
Now, most voters aren't likely to prod, you know, as deeply into the details of their policies. One question I think I probably have to ask about Obama as the first really serious contender for the presidency who's not white. Does that fact resonate in Indian country at all?
This is Kerry, and I use a very specific example in the time frame that Obama and Hillary were both here in the cities. My 11-year-old daughter got to go to both. you know, she comes home just so excited about Obama. And then I started to ask questions. And I think it comes back to what you're saying is in Indian country, we're used to elections. We see tribal elections, we see local, we're used to flash and smooth talk. And sometimes that's all there is. We want to see substance. And when you start to dig, you know, Hillary has put substance on the table. Coming back to the race question, there may be a relation there. I mean, I'm sure some people, but is that the flash in the pan? Is that the attraction? You know.
But what you're saying is Indian voters, maybe more than some other voters, are accustomed to trying to look beyond that. I mean, they're trying to really, they're reading into policy, maybe.
Maybe not at the level, you know, that we were talking about here, but certainly we're used to interesting promises,
interesting.
You know.
I think to take that even a step further, the races really break down so regionally. I think that people out west, not that I can speak for them, but I'm from there, tend to be, even if they're Democrat, significantly more libertarian. I think a great example of that was, look at the issues on the Pine Ridge Reservation a few years ago. South Dakota legislature was proposing to do an outright ban of abortion throughout the state. And the tribal chairwoman down at Pine Ridge said, well, you know, those laws don't apply to us. We can massage this so that we can, you know, provide these services. And the tribal members would not have it. Very socially conservative on that point. And she was removed from office. I think there are a variety of other issues, but that was the one that got the most attention in the media. So I think it really breaks down regionally. And to that point, you know, for Senator McCain being from Arizona, he might have a chance to actually have some effect and pick up some votes, but you got to define what's a win. Is getting 10% a win? Is getting 15% a win? If he's going to have effect, I think it's going to be at that point.
As a block, numbers-wise, Indian voters are relatively small in the context of the overall electorate. Is anybody really trying to get that vote? We're sort of talking as if they are, but are they trying? Are they trying hard enough?
This is Jamie. I think actually that over the last few years, 5, 6, 7, the Indian vote has a lot of attention has been paid. A lot of it has to do with the outcome of South Dakota race with Senator Tim Johnson. One of the advantages is really knowing that that's a centralized population, that you can identify location, you know, in large urban settings where population is dispersed, you know, communities are spread out, it's really hard to identify where people live. And so one of the advantages, and it's part of the reason why I think there is a lot of tension is being paid, along with the, you know, the sophistication that's growing out of Indian country in terms of young people and others who are politically savvy, and we're politically savvy because we deal with politics all the time. We're tribal governments. You know, we're dealing with our own elected officials. Our elected officials are engaged, in the case with Mille Lacs, unfortunately, in controversy with local government and possibly state government. And so it's become increasingly more important to look at mainstream politics and define how we're going to navigate. There are a couple other things that I wanted to speak to in terms of the courts and the effect of the courts. You know, trust reform is a huge issue in Indian country. The Colbell case, which is this large case, multi-billion-dollar settlement case where the plaintiffs have been...
The heart of it is just, what, billions in missing, mismanaged
exactly.
money that's been,
yes.
you know, from resources held in trust for Indian people, and the Department of Interior has just lost track of this. That was one of the issues that
Can't
certainly was on our list
find
today.
It all. Right.
Yeah. Well, let's, we can certainly skip ahead to that particular issue since you bring it up. does that still have incredible resonance on that's, reservations in Indian country?
That's a huge case. Even though there are individual plaintiffs, it really goes to accountability. The relationship between tribe and the federal government is that of a trust responsibility. And as the trustee, it's been proven now in this case and in other cases that the federal government hasn't lived up to that trust responsibility very well. They've mismanaged funds, they haven't delivered on numerous responsibilities that relate to health care and human services. The Indian Health Care Improvement Act, the reason that is so important is because You know, right now, Indian Health Service is funded at a level equal to the prison system, you know, and that's a very bad thing. We have, we were talking about presidential candidates, and I'm sorry, Jeff, we're jumping all over the place on you,
but the way these conversations work.
You know, I have been surprised about the amount in the state of Minnesota, the amount of supporters that I have come across, across the state, tribal leaders included, who have come out in support of Barack Obama. And, you know, again, even I am a Hillary supporter, but I have been surprised. And I think that conversation that he's been having has resonated. You know, they're looking at a change, a paradigm shift. We continue to fight, we're kind of fighting for scraps, and we need to change the perspective. Not only do we need to educate the state of Minnesota, the citizens of Minnesota, on what that relationship is in terms of that trust responsibility and that government-to-government relationship that most of the citizens, students, unfortunately, don't get a good grasp on. Not only do we need to do that, but we need to change how tribes, how that government-to-government relationship works. And Al brought up economic development. All economic development in Indian country shouldn't be, you know, casinos. You know, there are a host of opportunities. You see in this state, there are numerous leaders who are being, who are accompanying the governor and others to trade missions to other countries. You know, not very often do they look to Indian country and suggest maybe one of the tribal leaders attend, even though I think Audrey did go to China with the governor. But at any rate, those are things that, you know, that's how the conversation needs to change.
And this is Kerry, and Jamie and I have known each other for years. We've worked together. You know, to hear his logic laid out of why he's a Hillary supporter makes sense. But I would have walked in this room and thought he was an Obama supporter just because of there is this around Obama, this kind of flash in the pan kind of progressivism that's occurring, and this state is so caught up in that. And I bet he and I could list down on our fingers friends that we know that are behind that. And that worries me when you get to voters like Alex. Young voters get caught up in that, but what are the real issues as they relate to Indian country? And not everyone's going to do the research that, you know, that you did.
Is the general level of political engagement in Indian country pretty high right now? Are people excited about this election?
This is Reed. I say it's gotten much better. And Jamie, you know, has, I think, the exact scenario. In 2006, John Thune lost to Tim Johnson by 520-some votes. In West River, South Dakota, it's typically like 80-20 Republican. And it was the vote totals from the reservation that held that seat for Tim Johnson. And that was, and I think that is really sort of inspired a lot of Indian country to, you know, really make sure that people get out and vote and be significantly
because numbers-wise, the margins can be so thin.
Exactly.
That it really does
in
matter.
A close race, it really will matter.
Yeah. Anna Marie?
I think we as Indian people really enjoy having a good time, so I think we're all enjoying watching the Democrats tear themselves apart right now.
Some of us more than others.
Some of you more than others.
Well,
I think the general public as a whole is probably pretty engaged in that, and I think that's pretty deliberate. I think that candidates can come out there and they can make blanket statements about a lot of things like, oh, we're going to give you this, we're going to give you that. And unfortunately, the majority of the public that seems to want to perhaps fit in or be a part of a social group thinks that's all well and great. They don't dig deep enough to know, well, how exactly does government health care work? How exactly does it work? Who's going to be paying that bill? Where is it going to come from? How is it going to affect my ability to drive from here to the reservation? Because I might not have enough money in my pocket. You know, take a look at other economies. Take a look at other people that have that. I'm not saying that the philosophy of taking care of everybody is bad because we've had to rely on that for a long time. But I am also saying that we've also been, in large respects, made as a people to only take part in perhaps healthcare that they consider substandard. I know many of my friends and my colleagues from Red Lake, they don't go to their local government-run place. They go somewhere else. So there are different opinions of that. And I think Indian people are equally as smart as anybody else. They can take a look at the individual candidate and say, is that good enough? You know, we've been products of systems that just want our vote and give us a handout. And that doesn't work. That's called oppression. That's called keeping you somewhere. And we are very, very familiar with that. So when it comes to the three candidates, I think we sit back and race isn't the primary factor because it's not our race. There's not an Indian candidate out there. So it's not our race. So we're sitting back and taking a look at the race wars or the fights that they're taking part in. We're watching them.
I want to take this opportunity since you brought us there to sort of hit it head on and talk about it, because I think for non-Indian people, they probably had no exposure to this issue. The Indian Healthcare Reauthorization Act, mm-hmm. Which a number of you have mentioned so far, just about all of you mentioned while we talked with you getting ready for this, been passed by the Senate, never cleared the House. Who wants to explain to somebody who's never heard of the Indian Healthcare Reauthorization Act, why is this such a fundamental piece of legislation? What does it do, and why is it going to be at the very top of the list for you when the next Congress sits?
I'm going to run to the restroom. No.
Okay.
I can't begin to try to explain all of this. The long story short, I think, is that it is the overall omnibus bill that provides health care to American Indians all throughout Indian country, and that means a lot of different things. I can give you sort of a real-life example of what it does. My dad is the business manager of a federal clinic on the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe Reservation in central South Dakota. Over the past 8 years, their budget is continually cut back. People are let go, laid off, programs are moved around because the funding, as health care goes up and federal funding doesn't go up.
That's the crucial thing here.
Exactly.
That's what needs to be reauthorized, updated. Right. The funding for Indian health care is provided by the federal government. Has not kept up with, has it even kept up with inflation?
I don't believe so. And it, as Jamie mentioned earlier, last I heard, the amount of funds actually spent on Indian health care is actually below the amount of money that is spent in, I think it's the federal prison system. Don't quote me on that. But
so what's the holdup? I mean, it seems like a relatively obvious thing to reauthorize this, at the very least, to keep up with the cost of living.
I think there's a variety of different reasons why, but you have to justify it. Look, overall, American Indians make up 1% of the population. And this is an awful lot of money for 1% of the population. And it gets back to the education issue. Why exactly do they get that and nobody else does? Well, there's a very good reason for that. This wasn't something that was just sort of given for nothing. This was a bargain for exchange. This is part of the trust responsibility that resulted from the agreement between Indian tribes and the federal government that we would not do certain things, we would not live certain places in exchange for this.
Well, this reminds me of something of a quote that I noted from talking with one of you earlier, who said, at the government level, it feels like Indians have gone from an obligation to just another competing interest. Would you all agree with that?
Yes.
Yes.
Definitely.
Yes.
Are you hearing rumblings either in the presidential election or the statewide level of that changing, or does it still remain sort of a big black mark out there that nobody's really addressing?
Well, this is Carrie, and I would add one little subtle nuance to that, and it comes back to your original question about race. We don't see ourselves, at least I don't, and I bet if we went around the table, as being, you know, we're just American Indian. You know, as a white earther, Red Lake, Mille Lacs, we see ourselves as different tribal nations. I mean, we might come together, you know, upon time. And so not only is it we're kind of being another interest, but we're being clumped, you know. And in some ways, Mille Lacs has to compete nationally against not only all the other interests, but also all the other tribal interests. And so it, as it relates back to these, you know, to treaties, which we all know it's kind of basic government 101, or it should be, you know, treaties are right up there, right underneath the Constitution. These are contracts, and there are terms of these contracts that need to be upheld with separate tribal nations.
Well, how does that truth, because it is a truth, factor into the political reality of the fact that, you know, tribal nations are needing to employ lobbyists and play the game the same way that, you know, industries and other communities need to.
Which, Jeff, I would say to that point, from my limited experience, the way that it works at the federal level is the senators and the congressmen from the state in which the tribal nation is located are essentially primarily responsible for any legislation that, that those bands or nations have. And so I do not know what legislation Senator McCain has carried for the tribal nations in Arizona. My guess is it would probably be fairly significant. But the inequity of, you know, not all senators and not all congressmen are created equally, I think that that definitely impacts the tribal nations in different states significantly.
This is Arlen. I want to say something. Nobody's brought up the NCAI. And what the NCAI is the National Congress of American Indians. It was formed in like 1960s, and what it is it's a group of tribal leaders. And all the tribal leaders meet about four times a year, and they discuss government and tribal government issues, and they take them to D.C., and they do lobby for their individual tribes. So we haven't brought that up here, but that, you know, something of that sort does exist, and it's been around for 40 years.
How does that factor into what Kerry was saying about the different tribes being lumped into one category? To some extent, they need to sort of coalesce for political power, but the interests aren't always the same.
Right, because the sizes and the communities, like you said, I mean, there's a community that has 200 members, and there's a community that has 5,000 members. I mean, each tribe, there's over 500 tribes in the United States and Canada. And not, well, not Canada, but in the United States. And, you know, each one's vary. So, I mean, and they all have, they come from different, like they said, regions and different, you know, environments, and they all have different needs and different, it's hard to assess, you know, each one.
And we've talked about already, without me having to ask about it, some of the other issues that are seem really big right now, like the sort of more paternalistic approach to Indian gaming that's come up, and the BIA, you know, the trust fund payments. I want to ask Arlene about something that you brought up while I was talking to you, and you brought up the issue of apology, I think.
Oh, no, I just said that recently one of the senators issued an apology to the Native Americans. Was that in Kansas or Missouri or somewhere?
Well, but you made me think about it, and that's certainly something that comes up from time to time, is are there gestures that are still needed? Are there statements from the state governments, the federal governments, that can be made, should be made?
I don't know if you're asking me.
Well, you can take a stab at it if you
Somebody
like.
Somebody else can answer that one. I just threw that out there because I thought it was funny.
You know, and Australia's been in the news because they recently issued, you know, what was really a historical apology to their Aboriginal population. I know that made some people think here in the States about what's been done, you know, at a federal or a state level.
This is Jamie. I believe the state of Virginia did that as well. Mm-hmm. And I think it is really important because the level of ignorance that exists with the average citizen as it relates to tribal governments. We're talking about this trust responsibility, and if you were to ask 35 people who are walking on the streets of St. Paul what the trust responsibility obligation is that the federal government has to tribal governments, they'd be clueless. So there's been this huge failure on the part of the education system and part of the federal government to educate their lower governments, the state government, and then for the state government to educate county government. And it's really important. I just lost my train of thought.
Well, we're talking about apology, I guess. Is there a level of gesture that can sort of shock people into
definitely.
Better understanding?
This is Reed. One of the tribes that's near and dear to my heart is the Yankton Sioux tribe in South Dakota. And I think if you were to ask them, they've been in litigation for years now. And I know others can talk to this. Tribes don't want to have to defend their boundaries and their right to exist all the time. They don't want to have to run into court against the state of whatever and try to say that, you know, we're actually here. And if, you know, the federal government, I think rightly so, would take action to settle some of those issues once and for all, I think that, you know, that's more than a gesture, but that would be something that, it's hard to have a good relationship with the governments around you when you have to fight for sort of the ultimate issue of, well, what exactly are you? Are you really a government?
Well, but it sounds like you feel like maybe some sort of big statement of apology might be rather hollow
unless some of those specific issues are addressed.
Well, this is Carrie, and I'm wondering, are we differentiating between an apology and acknowledgement? Because certainly, Reed, you're correct. I mean, having to continually fight for what is essentially, you know, required, it's contractual. I mean, we wouldn't have this in any other contractual situation, per se. That's the law, that's what we follow. But we have to continually defend our rights. And acknowledgement is different than an apology. It brings on a whole different set of nuances, and how do you forgive, you know?
So is one more useful, preferable to the other?
I don't know. I'm asking, you know, and
all of the above.
Yeah. You can take either one.
I would take either, you know, an acknowledgement or an apology, and I would certainly acknowledge that an apology or an acknowledgement came, but I think it would be heard, thought about, perhaps, and then dismissed relatively quickly by a lot of people. But that has something to do with the fact that, and Jamie brought this up too, our public as a whole just isn't educated. And that starts from grade school. That starts from all of us sitting around this table as little children. We didn't get it. And if we grew up in Minnesota, we should have gotten it. We should have gotten those historical facts. And we should understand fully, you know, that before the state, you know, became a state 150 years ago, and I'm not going to say that word because I can't even say it, what the celebration is.
Sesquicentennial is coming up.
Before that, this land was entirely inhabited. People don't know that.
Well, let's
talk
about that.
They just don't know that.
The sesquicentennial is coming up here in Minnesota, and am I right in presuming that is perhaps deeply controversial as something to be celebrated in the way that, you know, we'll be shooting off fireworks here in Minnesota?
I think, as a whole, the momentum hasn't really quite taken off yet. I really don't. There's been attempts to collaborate with the tribes to get support. And, you know, one thing also I need to say is one size doesn't fit all for the tribes. I respect each tribe and each tribal leader as the head of the nation. They are the leaders of our nations, and I take direction, and we all do from them.
But on the issue of the celebration of the sesquicentennial, you feel like it has been approached with some degree of tact from the state's perspective, people who are organizing this.
I do know the executive director, who has a reputation for being very, very, very good person. So, yes, she's very respectful. She sat down and she apologized on her own behalf to the tribes at a meeting previously for the atrocities that were committed. She claimed that she did not know, and she wasn't educated either. We all can say that. So, and so she has been...
Yeah, Carrie, I can see you want to jump in here.
You know, this is Carrie. That's that wonderful gray area about what it is to be in our Indian community, because that's the official tribal. And though, you know, I agree, I respect our tribal nations, because of our tribal nations, we are what we are. We can't ignore the fact that we have a significant urban Indian population. And out there, I've heard such things as, you know, holding mock trials. I've heard, you know, there's kind of a whole...
To go along with the sesquicentennial.
Yeah, these type of things where... It's kind of because I think our tribal nations function so well in that political arena, or at least have to, because of the other issues we were talking about. Sometimes it falls to the individuals to be outraged and to be, you know, to be more, you know, publicly demanding.
So it could very differing opinions on that, certainly, you know, play out in different ways in different communities. Some of you told me about, in recent years, kind of a general draining of state resources away from Indian needs at the state government level. What specifically does the next legislature here in Minnesota need to take on in order to address this? Education is one big one, right? Anna Marie, I think you talked to me about that initially.
Currently, from what I've heard, and Jamie, correct me if I'm wrong, because we both sit on the same task force, is upwards of 89% of the students drop out who are from the American Indian community. That's outrageous. And I do know, from my own personal opinion and taking in various committee meetings, when you're talking about the achievement gap and they're talking to different groups, be it PTA or parent groups or whatever, it's always blamed on the Indian family. I don't think it's possible 89% of our families are completely, totally laid out dysfunctional. I just don't think it's possible. Therefore, something is going wrong at the school level in how those kids are being portrayed as learners. And certainly, you know, I know my father was completely fluent in his Ojibwe language, and he's very poorly educated, but he certainly is completely fluent in his English language, and he didn't have any fancy tutors. So obviously there's nothing wrong with intelligence in most of the cases.
Is part of it about bringing these liaison offices or officers back into departments like education, Veterans Affairs, I know has been another where there's been some progress, I think. But is it just about getting people back into these agencies that are concentrating on this stuff?
Perhaps to a certain degree, but I would like not to settle for agency positions that are lower level positions, which we can be ushered into. You know, but that can happen to anybody at state government, but we can be ushered into them depending on what the administration is going to do. And I quite frankly think since we're, First Nations people and critical in this state, that we should be walking side by side with the commissioners and the individuals that are out there. We should be side by side making those decisions together.
Would this be a new state government office?
You know, other states, this is Jamie, other states have taken that approach where they look at it, as an example, Anna Marie's the executive director of the Indian Affairs Council. Well, there are other states who have looked at commissioner-level positions to deal directly with Indian tribes within the state. And that shows a...
Which differs somewhat from the Indian Affairs Council set up here in Minnesota, right?
Yeah, that would be a higher-level position and a commitment, higher-level commitment by state government. And I think, what's unfortunately happened over the last few years is Indian programs have been low-hanging fruit. You know, when you have a state that's faced some fiscal situations of recent, $4.5 billion deficit a few years back. Unfortunately, for certain legislators and those within the administration, they don't value those programs, and so they're low-hanging fruit. And there have been a lot of programs that have been eliminated, but unfortunately, there have been several cases of instances where programs for Indian people have been eliminated, and that really goes to the priority of those folks in state government.
Well, before we wrap up, my producer suggests we make one late addition to the conversation, and why not? We have Arlene, I think you brought Crystal along with you, right? Crystal, pull up a chair here. Crystal is 18, one more young voter. And finding young voters who are willing to sit down and strap on a microphone like Alex, who's been with us here, and talk about politics is not always easy, so we'll take advantage of having her here with us. Are you finding, Crystal and Alex, we'll start with you, are you finding the people of your age, Indian backgrounds in particular, are feeling engaged with politics? Do you care about what's going on?
Well,
Alex?
The people, like the few that I know at my school, are somewhat involved, but I feel like, including myself, don't know as much as we could about all of these issues.
So this has been a little bit mind-blowing for you, maybe, to have all this information
flying around? Well, not entirely, but yeah. And I think, I guess it goes back to the whole education issue. If there's more teaching, everyone, that there'll be more of an understanding.
And Crystal, tell us quickly, give us your last name and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Crystal Norcross, I'm 18, I'm a student. I'm Ojibwe and Dakota. My Ojibwe side's from Fond du Lac and my Dakota side's from Sistan. And my school that I go to is just down the block. It's Multicultural Indigenous Academy. We talk about these issues at that school. And I'm proud to say that I'm an undecided voter.
You can't pin you down here.
Yeah, I'm an undecided voter. And the person I want to vote for, they have to know anything that's going on, in the Indian community. They have to be able to understand, because I know, like they said, the it's really shallow. I get questions all the time from just random people that go to my school about Indian community. And, I'm proud to tell them, but I want them to not have that knowledge, They have to know what they're talking about. For example, our president and sovereignty.
Sure. Do young people, young Indians, identify strongly with being an Indian or with their tribal affiliation as their parents?
I grew up with my grandmother, no mom and dad, and they my grandma, she has an impact on me. You know, she tells me different issues that, you know, follow us around. And if she has something to say about it, I'll go look it up.
So in your case, you have a very personal connection with your past.
Yeah.
How about the rest of you at the table as you talk with young people that you know, as you observe young people in the communities? Is there a drifting away here, or is the, you know, that sense of identity, that connection, as strong as ever? Yeah.
I'm on the board for the Indian Advisory Committee for St. Cloud State. That's where I was, one of the places I went to school and played hockey up there. So I've been on there for a couple of years. We have about 100 Indian students, a little over 100 Indian students that are going to school there. And we've got the Indian Center. We're trying to get more people involved. It's very difficult to get a lot of those Indian kids involved with the Indian Center. The ones that are more involved, I think, are the ones that probably came from the reservations, and they're up there. But then there's a Metro Indian like I was, and I think that's part of what it is. If you look around at some of the communities, and the way it breaks down is that you've got probably, I think it's probably 50-50, or maybe close to 50-50 of the Indian folks live off reservation. Well, if that's the case, those folks are probably more involved with other things besides their Indian community than the ones that live on reservation. And I see that with the Indian Center. The kids that are going to school at St. Cloud that were from the reservation seem to kind of gravitate together. And they may go to the Indian Center. The others, it's tough to get them to get back there.
Jamie, Arlena, I mean, you've worked with younger people. Are you sensing that, and are you worried about it?
There's a lot of factors. Of course, Native Americans are proud of who they are. But there's a lot of that, you know, sometimes people don't know where they came. There's people are adopted out. You know, urban population versus non-urban. I mean, the list can go on and on, but I mean, of course, the culture is definitely strong. Native Americans are definitely proud of who they are and where they come from. And basically, Native Americans generally know where they come from, or if they don't know where they come from, they can call up a grandmother or somebody and find out.
You're optimistic. I mean, those connections still exist.
Right,
can be revitalized.
Right, definitely. The culture is there, and yeah. The religion is there as well.
This is Carrie. I mean, having an 11 and 13-year-old, and I know, you know, Jamie has kids, and I know Reed's been busy, and you. And even with an 11 and 13-year-old, and having myself and my partner, you know, going out and engaged with things and going to ceremony or taking them to our events, it's still tough. My girls are both in public schools, and they're in that awkward age of you don't want to appear different. And if you can blend, that avoids the middle school angst. And so I see it, and it's a constant kind of, you know, re-encouraging. And I think to myself, you know, I didn't have as much of this with my parents, but I chose to do this. What must it be like with other kids whose parents aren't engaged? And so I think that's a part of it.
We need to wrap up this particular conversation. We've covered a lot of ground, and there's a ton more that can and probably should be covered. Thanks to all of you for coming and talking with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Which plum I am?